Welcome to Harlow on Healthcare. I'm David Harlow, and I invite you to join me by my virtual hearth as I sit down with healthcare leaders to discuss building the future of healthcare. Today, my guest is Dr. Stephen Swereduck, who is the medical director for the Shields Healthcare Group in New England. Shields has a network of imaging centers around many of the New England states. He is responsible for clinical oversight of the network, including quality assurance, protocol development, and direct management of the Shields Radiology Group. He also works hand in hand with radiology groups across the Shields joint venture partners to ensure consistency in care. And the care that we're talking about here touches more than 100,000 patients a year seen at Shields centers. Welcome, Stephen. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, David.
So I wonder if you could say a little bit more about Shields Healthcare and about your background and how you have found yourself in your current position.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So Shields Healthcare is a group of imaging centers, outpatient surgical centers, and urgent care centers, as well as radiation oncology at CT as well, which was founded sometime around 1986 or so. In 1986, we had the Brockton MRI Center, which was the first freestanding MRI center in all of Massachusetts. Shortly thereafter, we went to six MRI centers, and now we have 34 MRI sites throughout Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Maine, and we have a total of 49 MRI machines. We also have 17 PET CT sites. We have three ambulatory surgical centers, and we have radiation oncology site and two urgent care centers as well. Not to correct you, but this year we'll see over 200,000 patients
just in our imaging centers. Okay, go ahead, correct me. That's fine. Yeah,
but you know, that's only just including MRI. That's not including PET CT, our surgical centers, and so on. And I got to be here because one day I was a resident at Mass General Hospital and a fellow in neuroradiology. And I was sitting in the library, and a man named Tom Brady came up to me and asked me if I was interested in a moonlighting job. And I said, yeah, sure. I mean, you know, resident salaries, at least back then, were pretty low. And I was looking to, was newly married and looking to try to find a money for a house. So I said, sure, I'll take that job. And it turned out it was the Brockton MRI Center. And I went there. I worked there for about a year and a half or so. And then it was time for me to leave MGH fellowship and actually look for a real job. I was approached by Tom Shields Sr., the founder of our company. And he asked me if I was interested in a job. And I said, yeah, of course I am interested. And I took the job with the idea that I would be there for maybe 5 years or so and then move on to a different position. But 33 years and 6 months later, I'm still here.
So you're still there. And I guess the question is, where are we collectively? I should say that I met Tom Sr. when I was at the Department of Public Health years ago in the early 90s and had worked with the company at different points over time. A lot has changed since then in the world of imaging. And I wonder if you could give a thumbnail sketch of sort of where we are today and how different that may be, or maybe it's not so different from where we were.
It's very different. Sorry, it's very different. When I first got started with MRI scans, it would take us about an hour to do a study. We were only doing brain and spine imaging, and PET CT was in its early infancy. We used to call it spots and dots back then because the image quality and the resolution was not great. Today, we're doing exams in 10 minutes, 10 to 20 minutes, depending on the body part we're imaging. We now do breast MRI scans. We do prostate MRI scans, musculoskeletal scans, including shoulders, knees, wrists, joints, feet, and as well as body imaging as well. And it's really been incredible. For instance, the prostate scanning. it used to be that our only role in prostate MRI was just to stage patients with known prostate cancer. Today, that's completely different. Today, we actually use MRI scans to detect prostate cancer in patients who have an elevated PSA, or if they have an abnormal digital examination by their urologist, maybe a nodular prostate. And we also then use the MRI scans to localize patients with prostate cancer. In the past, urologists used to do what's called a fan biopsy when they were biopsying the prostate and sort of do random sampling in the prostate, looking to see if they could detect tumor. Now we actually localize the lesions, the prostate cancers, for the urologists by doing an MRI scan, a specialized MRI scan. They then take the data that we provided, the prostate mapping and the segmentations of the tumors, and they fuse that with an ultrasound machine and then use that to do guided biopsies of the prostate. So we've completely eliminated the random biopsies, and now we go and together as a team, we're identifying the prostate cancers much easier and with greater sensitivity. And PET CT.
So let me just stop you there and ask, whether it's prostate or other types of cancers, sometimes the question arises, are we screening in non-symptomatic cases that may never advance to a symptomatic point in the lifetime of the patient? Do we do patients a disservice in terms of the mental toll that comes with a cancer diagnosis and the physical toll of some of the further screenings that may include surgical screenings? How does this play in that conversation?
Well, I think what we do when we're using our images is we actually help and eliminate unnecessary biopsies and unnecessary procedures. So let's take prostate again, for instance. So young man comes in, elevated PSA, you know, maybe 3 or 4, whatever the number might be. In the past, they would have gotten a biopsy from the urologist, and one of those random biopsies, the fan biopsies.
Right.
Today, we'll do a prostate MRI scan, and if the prostate scan shows no evidence of a significant prostate carcinoma, we'll just put that patient into surveillance. We'll image them every other year, and we'll then do the PSA studies, the PSA samples, every other year as well. And that's, I think, has been tremendous because it's really, you know, a prostate biopsy is common. There's very few complications, but they do occur. And also, if we do find there's something called the Gleason score with prostate cancer. And if the Gleason score, the tumor is 6 or less, that means it's not aggressive and it's not going to be the cause of someone's death or severe illness. That'll just smolder along and probably be of no clinical significance for the rest of that person's life. So we can put them at ease and say, okay, you have a Gleason 6, we're going to watch you, but the odds of anything bad happening to you are quite low. Whereas if we find a Gleason 7 or greater, then we recommend, well, the urologist will recommend treatment. And whether that is surgery or radiation therapy or new cryotherapy, maybe using ultrasound to treat the tumor, that really helps. Again, like for instance, if we do an MRI scan and they have a prostate cancer that's spread beyond the confines of the prostate, then we know that patient's not a surgical candidate and that they should go to radiation therapy. So we help guide the treatment as well.
Okay, so it's a way of not only screening but figuring out where someone is in the journey and where to direct someone for further care, which makes more sense to me than sort of the concern, you're raising a concern about sort of unnecessary further testing, sometimes invasive testing, biopsy, et cetera. So that makes sense. And I imagine that sort of imaging would be relevant in other types of cancers as well. We're talking in detail about prostate, but I assume the same thinking would apply in other diseases.
That's right. So like for breast MRI, we're helping women who have dense breasts and they get a mammogram. The mammogram is less sensitive for detecting a tumor because of the dense breast. But with MRI, we can actually, we're very good at detecting tumors in patients with dense breasts. For patients who have lung cancer, we help stage different body parts. So if we're PET CT, we'll do a PET CT, and we will see whether or not the cancer is spread outside of the lung, and help determine whether or not that patient is a surgical candidate. We'll use MRI in the same patient, looking at other body parts like the brain, for instance, to make sure that the tumor hasn't spread to the brain as well.
So I'm wondering, as the field has advanced over time, what other sorts of technologies are brought to bear? We have improved machines, improved imaging, improved image processing. In medicine today, there's a lot of discussion about digital health, a lot of discussion about artificial intelligence and machine learning. And I'm wondering where this intersects with your work. Is there artificial intelligence at work in the analyses or in the image processing, in the machines that you're working with?
Oh, yes. We use artificial intelligence every day in almost every exam for MRI that we perform.
What does that look like? How does that affect your work?
Oh, so it makes, there's two benefits to artificial intelligence. When you do an MRI scan, in order to get good pictures, you have to repeat the same pictures over and over and over again, because there's so much inherent noise in the pictures themselves. Not acoustic noise, but just image noise.
Understood.
And the artificial intelligence knows, after with deep learning, they're going to process the images, but they're only going to go in there and they're going to remove the noise and leave the image data there. So that allows us to take images much faster. We're saving 30 to 40% time on scanning patients. The patients love it because they're not lying in the machine for 45, 50 minutes. Now they're in there for 20, 30 minutes at most. And also, we use artificial intelligence to enhance the images, to give us even greater resolution and a better picture quality.
And are there artifacts? Are there concerns about the accuracy of the AI? We hear about so many different sort of questions about AI in medicine, sometimes introducing questionable results. It sounds like we're talking about a very specific application here. How has that developed over time, and what's the range of levels of confidence that people put in this technology these days?
Well, for MRI, the confidence is very high. We are actually the first in the world to have installed at our Framingham facility artificial intelligence from GE. We have a great partnership with them, and we work together to develop the uses of artificial intelligence. So that's a given. It's unbelievably great what AI has brought to us. Other parts of imaging, if we're going to stick with imaging, it's developing. So for instance, I was involved in a project where we were looking at head CTs in patients who had head trauma, and trying to teach the machine to identify bleeds in the brain. And why is that important? Well, because so someone comes in for a CAT scan of the head, and perhaps you find there was a bleed, but that CT scan might have sat unread for 30 or 40 minutes. But with AI, the CT scanner can detect the hemorrhage, classify it as a bleed, and then alert the reading radiologist that you better put this scan at the top and don't let it wait, because this patient has a critical injury. Same thing for detecting lung nodules in smokers. AI has been quite good at for CAT scan. Some radiologists I know are concerned about artificial intelligence, and there's some people that are thinking that maybe it's going to replace us. I don't see that. I see that as only just making us better, making us provide better quality healthcare.
Well, that is a good thing, and there's certainly depending on the year, we hear about shortages of radiologists. So to the extent we can improve things in the radiologist's workflow, that is an improvement for us all, I suppose.
It is. The one downside of the advancements in MRI over the years has been back in the day, or early on in the 80s and 90s, when someone presented you with an MRI scan to interpret, there might have been 80 or 90 images as part of that examination. Today, there can be 800 images in that examination. So any help we can get in looking at all the images, decreasing our error rate is welcome.
If you're just tuning in, this is Harlow on Healthcare, coming to you on Healthcare Now Radio. I'm David Harlow, and my guest today is Dr. Steven Swieraduk, Medical Director of the Shields Health Group. Steve, we're talking about imaging. We've been talking about artificial intelligence improvements. And I guess the question arises not only we've been talking about improvement in the workflow, but also improvement in terms of speed to diagnosis or speed to identification of issues that may rise in an individual scan. Does this directly relate to any improvement in patient outcomes? I imagine that must be the case as well.
It does. One of the problems we all have in medicine, in every branch of medicine, is really determining outcomes. We know anecdotally that in some cases that our treatments or our procedures that we do provide increased outpatient outcome, better outcome, but that's difficult to measure for us.
Fair enough. Since you're sort of at the leading edge, so to speak, of the series of services that a patient would encounter. We've spoken a bit about particular types of imaging. Are there other types of imaging that you're working with where you've been seeing additional advancements or a steeper curve in improvement over the past decades?
Yes. In fact, over the just recently, we'll use PET-CT as an example. If someone comes in, well, again, back to prostate, because we've been doing a lot of prostates recently, and it's very common cause of cancer in men. So in the past, if someone had prostate cancer and they had their prostate resected or they had radiation therapy to the prostate gland, you had to monitor those people and see whether or not you thought they were having a recurrence of the cancer, if the cancer was coming back. If you do a PSA on someone who's had a prostate resection, prostatectomy, the PSA should be zero. But then over time, in some patients who have recurrent disease, the PSA is elevated by a little bit, but it's supposed to be zero. So there was no way to really detect or localize where the recurrent tumor was accurately until recently. At first, we were using this compound, this tracer called Exumin, and that was good, but it wasn't great. Just recently, a compound called PSMA, gallium-68 PSMA. It's prostate-specific membrane antigen. And it's a tracer that we use in PET-CT that is combined with the radioactive emitter, so you can actually see where the tracer goes to. And it's very specific for recurrent prostate cancer. So we can pick up lesions. You know, someone who has a very minor elevation of PSA, where's the prostate cancer recurrence? We can detect lymph nodes that have cancer in them, 3 millimeters in size or greater. So we can detect the recurrent cancer early and then help prolong that patient's survival or at least morbidity, make sure that, you know, we keep them as disease-free and functioning as well as they can. We've done PSMA is, there's only three centers in the East Coast. One's at Yale. We do it. There's one at Dartmouth-Hitchcock up in New Hampshire. And right now we've done about 50 or so of those cases. We have another 30 patients scheduled. And I see that as being a real game changer in the detection of prostate cancer. And if I might just add, it's also, I think, going to be very important in treatment of recurrent prostate cancer. There's a field called theranostics, which combines PET-CT and radiation therapy. A compound called, lutetium. It's a highly radioactive compound that you bind to the PSMA molecule. The PSMA molecule we know goes to the recurrent cancer, but instead of just going to detect, now the lutetium goes to the recurrent cancer and actually treats the cancer. And the results are amazing, just incredible. You can see, I've seen examples where someone has a very, very large tumor burden, and after a couple of treatments with this theranostics, the tumor's almost gone. It's and I see that as an area of great improvement coming in the future. But this is just going to become mainstream, and you'll see lots of different cancers, breast cancer, prostate, as I said, lung cancer. And we'll be treating those instead of local therapy, trying to just play whack-a-mole and trying to hit, you know, so you see a lesion recurring in the lung, you hit that with radiation or surgery. Now you'll be able to do systemic therapy and more effective than chemotherapy.
And so it sounds like it's a much more targeted therapy. It's going to be tumor-specific rather than the systemic chemo, as you mentioned, which often, as we know, can lead to significant side effects.
Yeah, it's smart therapy. It's just targeted therapy. It's really just amazing that we're actually here now.
So it sounds like it's somewhere in between like a truly personalized therapy and sort of a broader spectrum chemo. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, very much so. So what people are doing now is they're doing genetic analysis on tumor types, and you can tell whether a tumor has a certain receptor, and you'll know whether or not the treatment you're going to provide will target that receptor. And if the treatment you're going to provide targets a different receptor, you're not going to treat the patient with the wrong receptor, because that will be no benefit to the patient.
Right. So what else do you see on the road ahead in terms of improvement of diagnostics or therapeutics, or as you say, theranostics?
Well, with MRI, I see faster images. I see more applications for artificial intelligence. Right now, we do a lot of three-dimensional imaging, and right as of today, we can't apply artificial intelligence to the three-dimensional images. But that's coming very shortly. We're a pilot for General Electric, and we'll be doing that. We're first in the world to be doing that as well. PET CT, I see, in addition to the theranostics, I see different tracers for different tumors. Each tumor will have a more specific molecule, so we'll be able to determine, again, the spread or the presence of a tumor. CAT scan in general is quite good. We started the CAT scan years ago, and then we stopped because in Massachusetts, it's funny. There's lots of states have outpatient CT facilities, but it doesn't work in Massachusetts for some reason. We just don't know. We have never been able to figure it out. But outpatient CT doesn't work up until recently. But now the advances of CT, they allow us to perform calcification scoring for coronary artery disease. So if someone comes in and they have a risk factor for coronary artery disease, you do a CT scan and you determine how much calcification, if any, is present. And then at the same time, you'll inject contrast into the patient and actually do a CT angiogram where you can look at the coronary arteries themselves and see whether or not they have plaque, if they have obstruction, if the plaque is hard or soft, because soft plaques are the ones that will lead to heart attack. And it's quite good. Ultrasound is another field which has shown amazing growth. When I was a resident at Mass General, I used to take this thing that looked like an airline beverage cart and roll it around to patients' rooms and do ultrasounds. I did it myself as an on-call resident. Now, today, there's a little tiny handheld device. No, it's much smaller than, say, a bottle of water. And that communicates with an iPad. So you walk around with the iPad in your pocket and the transducer and do ultrasounds. And you're able to do ultrasounds that are better than we used to do before. It's quite amazing.
Right. The miniaturization is really amazing. I'm wondering, Steve, if you could speak to the experience of the past couple of years. We're nearly 2 years into the COVID pandemic, and we've really seen a sea change in the way that non-emergent healthcare has been delivered in this country, has been accessed in this country. And while much of healthcare has gone virtual, the kind of work that you do does not necessarily lend itself to a virtual encounter with a patient. So I'm wondering what the experience has been over the course of the pandemic and what learnings you take from that going forward.
Sure. I mean, pandemic, this has been quite a journey. I was never trained in infectious disease. I'm a radiologist and I was an internal medicine doc for a year. All of a sudden, I find myself as the lead person in charge of the Shields Healthcare COVID response. We've been learning all along the way, right? Because in February of 2020, we had no idea what we were getting into. No idea. Initially, we had lockdowns. We had hospitals closed their outpatient facilities for imaging. They stopped doing elective procedures. We stayed open that whole time. We stayed open. And what we found during that time was that the case mix, the types of diseases that we saw were very different. We were seeing much sicker patients. We were seeing patients that had critical findings that in a greater percentage. I mean, I'm in an outpatient facility. Typically, we don't really see the acutely ill people. Those people go to the hospital. But they were unable to go to the hospital, so they came to us. And that required us to make changes in the way we do business, the way we treat patients. We screen everybody now for COVID. We have a long list of questions we ask. We check vaccine status. We make sure that we put extra time in between each patient so that we provide a clean, safe environment in the machines. Our cleaning process is much more extensive than it was. Not that we were lax with it, but now it's very different. Our volume dropped during the peak of the pandemic it dropped by 70%. So we were only doing 30% of the volume beforehand. Now things have changed dramatically. I think the patients realize that it's better for them, or at least they feel more comfortable in coming to an outpatient facility than going to a hospital during this time. So our volume has increased significantly, we feel, because patients are choosing to come to us rather than go to the hospital. It's much easier. You don't have to walk through the hospital to get to your site. You don't have to sit in a crowded waiting room. It's been very different.
Great. That's been quite a journey. So yeah. To wrap things up, Steve, I'd ask you, if you were to wake up tomorrow and find yourself 5 years in the future, what's one thing in healthcare that you would hope or perhaps expect to find has changed drastically?
I'd like to see greater access for everyone to get care. I know different parts of the country, different populations have difficulty getting the same care as you and I might have, right? I would very much like for that to be improved upon and wake up and know that anybody, anywhere in the country will get the same care as you or I.
Well, that's something that I think we can all agree on. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, David. Thank you for having me.
You have been listening to Harlow on Healthcare. Join us at healthcarenowradio.com. Let's continue the conversation on building the future of healthcare together at #HarlowOnHC. I'm David Harlow, keeping the fire going and holding a seat open for you. Until next time.